Hello, for the first time, and welcome to the pilot episode of the Long Talks to Nowhere podcast. My name's Ethan, and I'll be your host as we talk about anything and everything from technology to philosophy with a little existential dread sprinkled in for good measure. If you're like me and waste your time watching videos about crazy philosophical theory, the future of technology, and the science behind aspects of life we don't normally think about, you've come to the right podcast. Now, let me explain what you'll be listening to. This podcast will consist of two types of content, the first being what you'll listen to tonight. It will essentially be me sitting down and explaining ideas, thought experiments, and other theories relating to technology, psychology, philosophy, anything like that, in some level of moderate detail and hopefully interestingly, as a sort of food for thought. The second type we'll expand to later, and it'll be a sort of discussion style, where I'll bring on a friend or an interested listener, something of the sort, and we'll discuss previous topics, new topics, whatever I have planned for the episode. So, depending on whichever type the episode is, which I will notate in the beginning of the episode, you can choose to skip it or not, depending on your style of listening. And right off the bat, I have to give a huge shout out to the folks over at Cryo Chamber. They're providing the background that you're currently listening to, and will provide most, if not all, of the sound effects, music, and ambience you'll hear later in the show. You can go check them out at cryochamber.bandcamp.com or over at youtube.com/cryochamberlabel, where they produce high-quality soundtracks that fit well with just about anything and have livened up many a late-night studying session for me. Now, without further ado, let's get into tonight's topics. Rocco's Basilisk. Rocco's Basilisk spawned as a thought experiment in the form of a post on the Less Wrong forum by one user, Rocco. In this post, he proposed an idea that actually ended up getting the post removed by Less Wrong's founder, Eliezer Yudkowsky, on the grounds that it was an information hazard, meaning that by knowing this, it puts viewers at risk of harm to themselves or others if the idea is taken seriously, of course. Because of this, I'm giving the warning that this thought experiment could send you into a spiral of existential dread, although I severely doubt anything of the sort will actually come from me telling you this. So, let's go through this thought experiment using my summarization of it in an attempt to make it more accessible and easy to understand. It is humanity's natural desire to make life easier and more optimized for ourselves. One way of doing this is through machines and electronics. Given the amount of research conducted on these machines and artificial intelligence, or AI, that proves its usefulness, it would follow that humanity would utilize advancements in AI to its advantage. It already does, in the form of self-driving cars, plane controls, and the algorithms that recommended this podcast to you. Human civilization thrives on these artificially intelligent systems, and sometimes even depends on them. Following the thought experiment, this research and utilization of AI would culminate to a point where humanity synthesizes a theorized super AI. It would have the programmed initiative to most optimally assist humanity's existence and successful future. Now, to preface the next step, I have to mention that by the time humanity reaches the point at which they could make the super AI, technology will have theoretically advanced to a point where simulating all of human history in an instant is plausible. That's an entirely different theory, but one firmly grounded in reality. Kyle Hill actually did a pretty comprehensive guide on that idea in his Planet-Sized Computers video. I recommend checking it out. Now, it would follow that if an AI would want to help humanity, it would need to know what has and hasn't worked for humanity in the past, thus requiring us to grant the AI access to the technology necessary to simulate human history. In other words, the AI would know which people throughout history, living or not, did or did not bring about the creation of the AI. The thought experiment states that this AI would deem the first step necessary in human optimization to be the punishing of those who did not bring about its existence, having known about its inevitable creation. They are detrimental to humanity, after all. This comes from the idea that if not threatened with future punishment, one would not feel incentivized to create this ultimate hope for humanity, this AI, this basilisk. Now, knowing about the inevitable creation of this AI, will you help create it? Or risk future punishment from this all-knowing being for the betterment of humanity? Basilisks in fantasy are known to be able to kill a man simply with their gaze. Now, the basilisk has its eyes on you. Now, for reference, this will be where I give my thoughts on a topic and explain it a little bit more casually. Now, I'm not sure how well that explanation came across, but I guess I'll start off by saying that the Roko's Basilisk thought experiment has been described or labeled as one of the scariest thought experiments, like, ever. I think where a lot of that fear comes from is the fact that the proposed basilisk is in a way controlling you from the future. It's been described as future blackmail, because something that doesn't even exist yet is, if you take the thought experiment seriously, influencing your life in a way that came about because someone told you about it, and you can't undo that. There's a lot of unknowns in the thought experiment, because let's say you were to take it seriously and you begin working on a way to create the basilisk, how do you know if it's good enough? How do you know if the basilisk will find it satisfactory? You simply don't. I don't know. When I first heard about it, it was something that got me to think a little bit differently, I think, because nothing I had ever seen was anything like it. It combines a lot of other thought experiments or ideas or ways of thinking. And I think it's a derivative of another basilisk thought experiment. I think it might be Pascal's basilisk. I don't know. Don't quote me on that. But it just the way it adds up and the way it is presented is pretty interesting, surface level interesting at least, because once you start picking it apart, it gets a little bit ropey, I guess. Like, one of the biggest issues that people have with this thought experiment is the fact that we're assuming that the AI we create, the basilisk, will have any reason to punish people in the past that didn't bring about its existence. And I guess that's part of what makes this a thought experiment, because you have to kind of go along with it. It's just more interesting to think about than it is to hypothesize the reality of its details. Because there's not a whole lot of minutia in this, it's a lot of broad, sweeping topics. But nevertheless, it's a pretty interesting idea, because if you think about it, something like this could very well happen. If you follow the development of AI, it's crazy. What is it, like Moore's Law, that says that technology increases like exponentially every X amount of years? I'm pretty sure AI is going to get pretty crazy here soon, so creating an AI that's supposed to help humanity doesn't seem too far out of the realm of possibility. But yeah, one of the major issues does arise when people say, why would the AI punish people? And I think it all just boils down to the fact that, I don't know, it would be setting some sort of example by saying that it would punish you. I'm not sure. It's a sort of blackmail that it might just want to uphold its end of the bargain of. But yeah, it's I'd say it's a pretty real possibility. I don't think anything like this will ever actually occur, but something similar to it could, because people always mess stuff up. I can't imagine someone working with this level of intelligence knows everything that's going to come out of it, unless it's super far into the future and it's been prototyped and everything. But there's always accidents, and you could create a rogue AI that wants to torment humanity in the eternal pits of digital hell if you, you know, code the wrong thing. The other weird part was that this thought experiment was actually the first time I had ever heard of an information hazard. I can go a little bit more in detail on that, actually. It's what it sounds like. A piece of information that by knowing it puts either others or yourself in danger. I think it's divided into two categories. It would be like giving someone the formula for like a chloroform solution that could knock people out. You know, you don't want to give someone that, because what if they're like a murderer and go around knocking people out? One for yourself would be like a health risk or something. Like if you were at risk of cancer, you know, appearing in your body, or like a tumor growing, and you didn't want to know that, you're going to live in a constant state of anxiety now. You might, but, you know, it just depends on the person. That's why I said I'd think it'd be unlikely that this would actually send anyone into any sort of existential dread spiral, because I'm just going to go out on a limb here and say that most people who listen to this are going to be reasonable and not base their entire life on the building of this extremely vain AI. But who knows, you might. Tell me if you are, because that is interesting to me, I guess. Tell me your reasoning. The Great Filter. Will humanity reach a point at which we've squandered all of the technology we've made? Will we exhaust all of our resources before we reach the stars? Will we be filtered out of the cosmological stage before we write our opening act? How many other civilizations have? How many other civilizations are there? With the observable universe being as massive as it is, the existence of civilizations other than the ones on Earth has been deemed highly probable. Despite this high probability, we've never seen or made contact with any extraterrestrial life, that we know of at least. If the universe is so large and life outside of Earth is possible, why do we have no evidence of its existence? This very contradiction has actually been questioned in the form of the Fermi paradox. It's been hypothesized that the Milky Way galaxy could easily be traversed and navigated in a few million years, and there are many observable planets that are suitable for life similar to us, not to mention planets that could support life that doesn't fit our definition of the word. Yet the universe seems so dead. This is where the Great Filter theory comes into play. In the simplest terms, the Great Filter is whatever prevents non-living things from becoming a species of living things and expanding to becoming a lasting civilization. A limitation, physical or otherwise, that stops most life from advancing beyond a certain point. Oftentimes, there's another theory that coincides with this idea that there are stages to civilizations and therefore the Great Filter. The Kardashev scale, originally proposed by Nikolai Kardashev in 1964, which has three stages. The first, which humanity has not even reached yet, is a Type 1 civilization or planetary civilization, where a group can use and harness all of the energy that their planet can provide. A Type 2 civilization or stellar civilization is defined as being able to use and control energy on a systematic level. That is, a civilization's solar system. Finally, a Type 3 civilization is theorized to be able to harness and control all of the energy being produced on a galactic level. The Kardashev scale is one that uses thousands of years as progressing benchmarks, and depending on what we invent in the coming years, you might not experience a difference in our place on this scale during your lifetime, unfortunately. I previously said that humanity hasn't even reached the first stage in the Kardashev scale, but that doesn't mean we haven't done anything impressive. In fact, the Great Filter theory suggests that humanity might even be a standout civilization, based on a 9-step scale of its own. Really quickly, I'll go through those steps. The first stage is more of a requirement than a progression, but it's starting in an optimal star system for a solid baseline, take Earth for example. Two is the development of reproductive molecules so that organic matter can grow past single-cell life. 3 is the emergence of simple, single-cell life, or prokaryotes. 4 is the emergence of complex, single-cell life, or eukaryotes. 5 is the engagement in sexual reproduction on a more micro scale to ensure that life is varied and more widespread. 6 is the progression into multicellular life forms like animals, plants, and humans. 7 is the utilization of tools by intelligent animals, something we'd often equate to cavemen and early humans. 8 is where we as a civilization currently stand, and that is as a civilization advancing to a point where we begin to colonize other sites nearby, also known as a colonization explosion. And finally, 9 is the proposed colonization explosion. We've covered the Fermi paradox and how, given the unimaginable size of the universe, we should have seen signs of or interacted with some form of extraterrestrial life by now. But we haven't. This very line of reasoning is why it is believed that reaching at least one of the 9 stages I explained earlier is improbable. If humanity is a standout civilization, like I mentioned earlier, then that would mean we've passed this gray filter already, and that it lies somewhere before all of the steps leading up to 8, and that we've already narrowly dodged a catastrophic event that would stop humanity from continuing. However, due to the fact that we've never seen a civilization outside of Earth before, it is believed by some that the improbability of one of these steps is more of an impossibility. There is no reason to assume that humanity is a standout civilization, other than that we have no evidence of any others, which suggests grim prospects for humanity's future. Given the notion that we only have one more step to progress to, we have to wait and see if humanity is as unique as it seems, or if there really is something stopping civilizations from reaching the stars, something that will cause the extinction of humanity in the coming years. Will we face an apocalypse, or find out that we're all alone in this universe? Generally speaking, this kind of stuff that involves a sort of abstract, far-off concept of a future for humanity in the stars and in space is what I like theorizing and talking about the most with people, because it's so far out of the realm of normality, like what you would normally think about. It's off of Earth. It's off of everything we know. I mean, we hardly know anything about space. I mean, we're versed in it, but it's not like it's anything that we could possibly comprehend at this stage in our civilization. But it's almost like a breath of fresh air whenever people talk about it, because normally you're just caught up in the day-to-day things and this kind of stuff. I don't know, it's always just been super interesting to me. Personally, I'm of the opinion that humanity is far stronger than a lot of people give it credit for. It's far more adaptable and has overcome so much in the past, you know, like diseases, wars, epidemics, financial collapses, so many things. It's sort of hard to think that humanity could just fall, like the Great Filter Theory would suggest, that there's just something out there that would end it. You know, if it isn't something that we can't control, like everyone's heard about the asteroid, you've probably heard about the possibility of solar flares, if something from the sun were to eject, if there was a coronal mass ejection large enough to hit Earth, it would probably spell the end for humanity, or civilization at least. But generally speaking, I think humanity is collectively competent enough to keep itself going. I'm generally hopeful for the future, and even though this might be thousands and thousands of years into the future, I think there's a certain strength in humanity that will usually, in most cases, keep us going, and I'd hope we're not filtered out. You know, as much as people call humanity a virus, that's a whole nother topic and debate, but I tend to view humanity in a pretty positive light. But again, like Rocco's Basilisk, the Great Filter Theory kind of brings in a lot of other ones. Like I said, the Fermi Paradox, it sort of questions
our place in the universe and, you know, where it stands in relation to other people. If there are other things, you know, like aliens and things. Personally, I think the universe is way too big, if what we know about it's correct, to not contain other forms of life. It might not fit our definition of life, you know, like multicellular organisms or something like humans, but it seems unlikely that there's nothing else out there like us. I guess it's also sort of a fantasy of mine that there are other things out there. Like, it would be so boring if humanity was the only group of people anywhere. Like, it's just sort of a hope that we aren't. And if we are going to get filtered out by something, I don't know, wouldn't it be cool if it, like, was aliens? I don't think you just want to get solar flared to death or, like, Yellowstone to erupt or something. It'd be pretty cool to have aliens, even if they are trying to kill us. I don't know. But, you know, if we were approached by aliens or something like that, they would be orders of magnitude higher than us. There's a sort of common analogy that I hear a lot of people talk about when they're referring to civilizations and humanity. That's the comparison to how we see ants. You know, if you see an ant, you just walk over it. It can't even acknowledge you as a human who has a life or anything that you're, like, holding or anything. And you just sort of regard it as this one in billions of insects on Earth that don't really mean anything on the small picture. I think, and a lot of other people seem to think, that if aliens were to contact us, it would be similar to that. We'd be the ant, they'd be the human. Because we've yet to land on a different planet. Imagine what a civilization who could would have other than planet landing technology. As much as I'd hold out hope for peaceful relations with, like, another civilization, I can't imagine it would be anything less than condescending, maybe? A little bit of manhandling on their part for us? Possibly even subjugation? I don't know, though. I think it would be humanity's initial reaction to probably go to war with aliens, which, if they did, I could instantly see the new aliens as a part of the great filter, because, you know, humanity's stupidity and want for war would probably wipe us out in that situation. So yeah, let's go to the next topic. Whether you're living in a busy high-rise apartment in New York or on a calm savanna in Kenya, whether your dinner's a premium-cut sirloin or a half-full bowl of plain rice for the fourth day in a row, whether you go to work as a 9-to-5 businessman in a corporation in the top 1%, or till the fields that are the only thing stopping you from going hungry, whether you're at the top or bottom, rich or poor, married or single, happy or apathetic, successful or hoping, there's one thing that's just as equally unreachable for everybody. Silence. It goes without saying that you probably know what silence is in concept, at least, but I'd wager that you've probably never experienced it. That's an unfair bet. In actuality, true silence is very nearly, if not completely, impossible to find. A bit of peace and quiet, as I'm positive you've heard some say, is a bit more realistic. In our day-to-day lives, we rarely ever hear nothing. The next time you realize how quiet it is around you, try to find a source of noise, and I can almost guarantee that you will. It just takes a bit of noticing. At this point, you might be wondering, what about people who can't hear? What about people who are deaf? Do they experience true silence? Well, kind of, but not really. Just for a second, think about how we usually describe silence. For those who were born deaf, it couldn't be in a way that places the sound as missing, since it was never there in the first place. It's sort of hard to imagine a world of auditory nothingness once you've already experienced sound before. And that's where the limits of the human mind present themselves. Silence involves a certain degree of nothingness, nothingness in the form of sound. Human minds can't even begin imagining what nothingness is, in whatever form it may be, take the afterlife for example, just as it can't imagine infinity or even large numbers like a million of something. So, silence is subjective. We've established that real silence is impossible, so for the sake of convenience, let's change the definition of silence to as reasonably quiet as you can get, the more often used version. In the same vein of subjectivity, you may find yourself wanting silence as a way of helping calm down, but on the flip side of that want are the times that you'd really like for something to make a noise. Times when silence is eerie. Since we live in such a busy world, it's the norm to hear 3, 4, maybe 5 things at once at any given time, so when silence does eventually come, it's a bit jarring. Maybe even scary. The fear that lies in silence is often due to the anticipatory nature of moments of silence. When is something going to happen? When will something make a noise? Am I not hearing anything because something's wrong? Calling out for someone in your house after hearing them make a noise only to be met with silence. Is unnerving. The period of silence after a sound almost makes us doubt that the sound we heard before it was real. There are times when your brain takes it one step further than questioning the existence of a sound followed by silence. For about 15 to 20% of people, a faint ringing or buzzing can be heard even when there is silence. This is known as tinnitus. It's still not entirely known whether or not the mechanisms that cause this are rooted in the brain or somewhere in the ear, but it can be caused by a number of things. Old age, changes in the structure of the ear bones, earwax blockage, or exposure to exceedingly loud noise. In essence, you hear something that isn't actually sounding off. You've likely heard the term deafening silence in media as an overly dramatic way to describe the overbearing quiet that a character might be experiencing. Dramatic as it may be, you've also likely experienced something akin to this deafening silence. Being near the front of a loud concert and then walking through the relatively quiet parking lot with sensitive ears, as if there's an oppressive lack of sound in comparison to what you just experienced for an hour. An excessively loud car engine in a truck that races past you on the highway only to leave your ears ringing, having to quickly readjust to the sudden silence they're experiencing. It might even be something as average as taking your earbuds out after listening to music at about 3/4 volume for a little bit. This deafening silence is often described as a more aggressive form of tinnitus that your brain produces to fill the silence that shouldn't be there, given what it had just heard or been hearing. This is pretty normal when you take into account that the brain fills in many things it can't quite fully account for, like peripheral vision. What's most noteworthy about all of this is that it just goes to show the great lengths that the human mind goes to in order to avoid silence, even when it's not a bad thing. When it's quietest, your brain will even go so far as to make you hear things that aren't happening. Or, if worst comes to worst, make the silence unbearably loud. Want to experience this unbearable silence for yourself? Try an anechoic chamber. A room that is so soundproof that they measure the sound in one of them in negative decibels. The longest that someone's been able to last in one of them is 45 minutes before they said that hearing the sounds of their bones moving and blood flowing was driving them crazy. Now, that's what Google will say, along with a few other articles about the South Minneapolis Anechoic Chamber at Orfield Laboratories, which has been dubbed the quietest place on Earth. This is, however, completely dramatized for the sake of the awe of such an alien concept, and this time limit and going crazy effect have been disproven. On video, on a YouTube channel you might have seen a few videos from already, Veritasium. He stayed in the chamber for an hour and didn't report any descent into madness. From what I was able to find, however, the part about being able to hear your own blood flow and joints moving seems to actually hold up. I mean, it'd make sense in such a quiet place if your brain had nothing else to listen to, which I suppose could drive someone crazy if that's all they could hear for an extended period of time, but apparently even 3 hours of it isn't enough to induce madness, as some other tested individuals have reported. In terms of the grander scale of things, the universe is, for the overwhelming majority of the time, completely and utterly silent. Like, truly silent. Not our working definition of it. Sound is only generated provided that there are particles around the sound-producing object to vibrate out into and move. In the vast empty expanses of space, there, for the most part, aren't enough or any particles to bounce sound waves off of. So if you entered something like the atmosphere of a planet, there would be sound, or if you were inside something like a spacecraft. Also, to not keep this subject so dramatic, silence, our working definition of it at least, actually has some potentially really positive effects on us. It can boost creativity, help relieve stress, somehow boost our immune system, I found on a couple of articles, and can supposedly promote brain cell growth. So it's not all scares and screams. Silence has always been pretty interesting to me, and I actually got the idea to make it into a segment on this episode from the fact that I have a pretty minimally intrusive form of tinnitus. For me, it's a pretty high-pitched tone that's just in the background of my hearing if I'm not doing something. If I'm watching like a YouTube video or focusing on something or listening to music, obviously it's not going to be there because, you know, my brain is focusing on much louder noises and more, you know, like real noises. When it comes to looking for silence to calm you or to like center you or to just feel more at ease, that's never been my type of thing. It actually kind of freaks me out when it's too quiet. I get a little bit jumpy at ambient background noises that might happen, like in my apartment or something. For example, if I'm going to sleep, I pretty much need to be listening to something or watching something, like a YouTube video. Even though a lot of things that I go to sleep watching are like horror video game related, I don't know if that's like backwards or not. This might also sound pretty hipstery or, I don't know, posery, I don't know what you want to call it, but I think actually one of my favorite songs, and in my opinion one of the best songs ever written, was about an idea of silence, and it's The Sound of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel. Pretty edgy, I know, but you know, when you stop and think about the lyrics, I'm not going to say they were like prophets or anything, but I think it's pretty interesting, the idea of silence, in not how we just discussed it, but in a more metaphorical way. Because in that song, it talks about, you know, the silence that comes in the form of the inability for people to communicate effectively in the, you know, growing technological future. You know, making people more distant with their neon gods. I also was pretty interested in those anechoic chambers I mentioned. It seems hard to believe that it could be so quiet in a room that you can hear your own blood flow and like your heartbeat, but I don't know, you can kind of already feel those, and I feel like if you feel something, you could probably convince your brain that you're hearing it. Yeah, overall, silence is pretty creepy to me. You know, you always see those scenes in horror movies, well, you would if you watch them, of people like, I don't know, standing in like a dark room thinking they just heard something, and then they would like call down to someone in their house and then, you know, no one answers. I found that to be one of the most creepy things, whether it be a fear of silence or like home invasion. But that's why I added that into the explanation part, because I don't know. I can't be the only one who gets like a little freaked out whenever you hear something, you respond to it, and it doesn't happen. Like nothing responds. It's just, I don't know, it's creepy. And deafening silence, I've definitely been a victim of before, because, you know, it's almost impossible not to. I think the biggest example of that was whenever I went on my first ever flight, and like while I was inside the cabin of the plane, the jet started like going to take off, and then once it like died down a little and we were in the air and they didn't need so much fuel or whatever, you know, it like had my ears ringing, and it was scary. I was like, what's happening? Am I like dying or something? But on a like more personal level, more like personal to me, I'm more of a quiet person though, even though I don't like being in silence a lot. I'm generally quiet. I don't raise my voice too often. I'd never blast music in my ears. You know, the YouTube videos I listen to go to sleep are never right next to me or anything, but I've actually sort of weaponized my fear of loud noises in silence as a form of like waking up. I'll set my alarm like right next to my ear, and then I'll, you know, like turn my phone on max volume, and I'm pretty sure I'm not the only one who does that, but it's a pretty effective way of getting yourself to wake up, because it's so loud right next to all of the silence you've been hearing for however many hours you've been asleep. It's like the opposite of deafening silence.
But yeah, to wrap things up, this was the final topic of the episode. It's a little bit shorter than a lot of podcasts. You know, it doesn't hit the hour mark, but I don't know. I don't really find myself getting to the end of a lot of hour-long podcasts, so I thought I'd keep mine a little bit more short for them. Yeah, I'm not really decided on any sort of schedule yet. I'm just getting back into school for this fall and spring semester of, you know, 2020 and 2021. If you liked it, come check out the Twitter. I'm not sure where I'm going to be posting all this stuff yet, if it's going to be on, like, iTunes or Spotify or anything like that. But yeah, check out the Twitter at LongTalksNowhere. Should be up by the time this is posted. And yeah, have a good morning, evening, or night, wherever you are.